I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, we'll talk about the holidays, managing expectations and disappointments, and New Year's resolutions. But first, 10 Lessons in Power Psychology. That's the title of a new book written by psychologist Michael Abbruzzese, who's with us this morning. Good morning.
Hi, Mindy.
All right. So I guess the first question is, what is power psychology?
Well, power psychology, you know, psychology has been around for a long time. And psychology really is the underpinning of everything. Every time you read a book about self-help, every time you hear what the economists are trying to do for the economy, engineers trying to build a new road or manage traffic, it's all about psychology. Yeah, all these people who are not psychologists who know that they have to tap into the psychological aspects of people's functioning in order to affect some kind of change. And I think we could probably look around in society and say that a lot of these people, some of the engineers and some of the economists, they're not doing such a great job because people will always find a way to zig when they zag, and they don't really account for that kind of stuff. And power psychology really is an emergence of the standard research psychology that started over 100 years ago, really how you can take the findings from the laboratory and the clinical sessions and all the stuff that we know that we've been looking at for the past, well, the modern era probably started around World War II when we started to do classifications for people going in the army. Take everything we know back in from the 1940s forward and distilling it down so people can use those things and apply the power of psychology in their everyday life to make changes as opposed to just going in the therapy office and just talking about stuff, talking about stuff over and over again, which is for most folks is really not very helpful and actually has been for some folks is very counterproductive and damaging.
So you have a quote at the beginning of the book that says, "The happiness of your life depends upon the quality of your thoughts." Marcus Aurelius, philosopher and Roman emperor. That's so true, isn't it?
That's true. And every time you read a book from people who are doing self-help books, they always talk about the power of your thoughts and the power of your perceptions, as though they've discovered something new. Even William James talked about this, and he was writing in the 1880s, I think, or a little bit right around that time. But people have been writing this, you know, for thousands of years, people have known this. The difference is, just because you know something, I can tell you we should really try and control our thoughts better. Easily said. Try doing it sometimes. It's very, very difficult. We know how to take care of people. We can all be caregivers. But now we know there's something that's called caregiver fatigue, caregiver exhaustion. What do you do after you've been trying to do all these kinds of things and you run into some obstacles? So the difficulty really is trying to take psychological techniques and tell people how to help themselves to get started, how to help themselves once they run into a roadblock, and how they can help themselves when all the other kinds of help they get out of a book is not very successful. So that's the idea of writing this book, try and give people a sampling in 10 or so different areas so they can get jump started and know what to do in these areas.
Right. So in the preface of the book, you write, "No matter how many hours a week I worked, I could never reach very many people because the knowledge I had was essentially rationed by insurance companies and income." So you decided to write this book, create a website, and offer a free newsletter.
Right.
So this really came out of, I guess, a frustration then that you had.
Right. Psychology has always been, since the 1970s, since the 1970s has been a covered feature of most health insurance plans. But what most people don't know is that they have never had parity between what they used to call mental health benefits and physical health benefits. So if you had cardiac problems or a pregnancy, they would give you a certain set of benefits. But if you had depression or anxiety, which prevented you from functioning either in your family or in the workplace, they quite often wouldn't give you very many benefits at all. And when I started out with a new company, I think it was called Oxford, if my memory serves, some of my colleagues were getting, they were offered $35 a session by the insurance company. It cost more to run their office. They couldn't see people at $35. So what people don't realize is that the health insurance industry, the health insurance regulates the benefits. It's not the government, not the state government. It's not the Department of Public Health. It's really the insurance companies who regulate everything. And because they tried to empanel physicians, so they would say, "We have the best physicians on our panel, come to our panel." In reality, health is just a commodity now. And they also said the same thing about chiropractors and dentists and psychologists and marriage and family therapists. They empaneled these people. Really what they did, they tried to find a rationale to keep people off the panel. So if you had a certain kind of insurance, you couldn't come and see me because the insurance company would say, "Well, in order for you to see this licensed psychologist, just because the state has licensed him and qualified him and gone over his qualification, no, that's not good enough. We have to do it ourselves for every single person who applies to our panel. So a physician who is a board-certified cardiologist has to go through the same kind of credentialing process because they don't think the Board of Medicine did a good enough job qualifying this guy, which is baloney, of course. And now there's a proliferation, an alphabet soup of agencies who regulate, cross-regulate, and really feed each other. I got a notice from one of the insurance companies who said that I was a member of their panel. They wanted to recredential me. I can't find anywhere in my records that I was a member of their panel. And one of the rationales they gave is because a regulatory agency who is an advisor to them says that every 3 years all their people on the panel have to be regulated or recredentialed, as though the insurance company is totally helpless. They couldn't do anything. This nonprofit bipartisan panel says that we have to recredential. That's a bunch of nonsense, So it really has developed a proliferation of regulations and rules that have gotten, they really have increased healthcare so much. The cost of healthcare is not because of the new benefits that people are getting. It's because of the impositions and limitations that the insurance companies have put on it.
This is kind of aside from the book, but I wanted to ask you this question since you're talking about this. So do you think that this is part of the reason that we're seeing fewer people go into this field? I mean, we have, a shortage of psychiatrists, and it's not just here in the Cape. This is nationally.
True.
Is that part of the reason, do you think?
Well, it's a couple of things. First of all, people who go into the psychological healthcare field are a different kind of animal that go into medicine. And the people going to medicine are a different kind of animal that go into MBA programs or go into law school programs. There's just a certain self-selection that happens. And you will find out a law of economics that applies is the bad money drives out the good. Mm. So when managed care came into the medical field in full force back in the late 70s, early 80s, you had a lot of physicians who said, I'm going to cash in. I'm going to go buy a vineyard someplace, and I'm not going to deal with this. Mm-hmm. And you had a lot of new people coming up in the field who were just getting out of medical school, and that's really what the HMOs, the health maintenance organizations, counted on, because they don't know how it was before.
Right.
So they drink the Kool-Aid, and they buy into the fact that they can have a 9-to-5 job, they never have on-call, they don't have to worry about this, that, and the other, because the organization will take care of all their administrative costs, and they have a different kind of quality of life. They also have a substantially lower income, but since they never had a great income to begin with, that's okay for them. Mm-hmm. So for people who are just coming up now and 2 or 3 generations later, they don't know what it was like. Mm-hmm. And it's easy for the insurance companies to manipulate the quality of care that way.
All right. So back to the book. Really, changing behaviors is what this is about. And I know you said that's easier said than done. But once you sort of get the gist of it, I mean, you've got 10 sort of lessons in this book. Mm-hmm. And once you sort of practice that and do that, you could really apply this to anything. So in some ways, this is maybe easier than you might think.
Well, it is. It is. The lessons that I wrote in there, they're very, very small. They're very repetitive. And they pretty much, several pages harp upon the same theme. Because my goal in putting the book together was to give people a smattering of lessons that they would get if they actually had been to a therapist office, what a good qualified cognitive behavioral therapist would provide them in session. And they can apply this to many different areas. And I've got 10 areas in there. And the application of the different areas really is an idea of exactly what you can accomplish in your life by using these sound psychological techniques. And the list price on the book is about the price of what it would be for a copay, less than a copay, because some of the copays I've seen now have doubled with the new healthcare law. And it's going to be on Amazon, so they're probably going to charge a lot less. So you can really get the benefit of 10 lessons in that you might have gotten from a qualified therapist, and you get a lot of coaching in the book on how to use them.
You'll also be able to get it from the local bookstores. I want to just add that in there.
I'm not sure how many local bookstores. They have to order it.
Yeah,
but I mean, it's going to be available to do that.
Yeah. Some people like to shop at their local bookstores. All right. So you talk about the importance of practice, but not just practice. You say practice does not make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect.
That's right. And by perfect practice, I don't mean that you have to be flawless. I didn't say flawless practice. I just said that practice that is good enough to accomplish your goals. So if you want to hit a baseball or a golf ball, you have to practice. That doesn't mean you're going to hit a home run every single time you do it, but you're going to get good enough to be able to do what you need to do, which in this case would be hit the baseball, hit the golf ball to improve your game. So you have to practice appropriately, and you have to get appropriate feedback. And once you practice correctly, then you're going to make behavior change. Because simply by doing something over and over again, well, that's another word for practice. It's simply reinforcement. But if you do something the wrong way for 10 years, you've just practiced the wrong way for 10 years.
You've perfected it the wrong way.
Perfected a big oops. That's correct.
Yeah.
So perfecting things rely not on flawlessness, but on just doing it the right way repeatedly.
Yeah. One of the things, too, you know, when you think about your own thought process, some people have a tendency to see the glass half full, some half empty. So if you're one that sees the glass as half empty, you might maybe have a little more work in trying to control those thoughts.
Well, it's true. And negative thinking, negative cognitions seem to happen to us more easily than positive cognition. We have to train ourselves to do that. And the reason that is because we are hardwired as human organisms to notice discrepancies, to notice things that are out of place. So we notice things that are just a little bit different. And things that are a little bit different are sometimes interpreted through our flight or fight ancient mechanism of self-preservation to be good or bad. Mm. So if we see something different, our automatic default switch is most likely to be something like, whoops, something going on, got to pay attention to this. It's a heightened state of awareness. Now, some people call that a heightened state of anxiety, and it's not. It's simply a heightened state of awareness. Our biological system, our central nervous system, just cues us into, okay, pay attention to this. Then the impulse gets kicked up to our cognitive functioning in our frontal lobes, and then we make a decision. Oh, yeah, this is dangerous. I got to do something. No, it's not dangerous. It's going to be okay. And we have to overcome our natural tendency to process negative emotions. That's why they have people in the military, people who do martial arts, people who take driving lessons, to do something the right way, to overcome their natural tendency to be hesitant or to overprocess some information. You can't be in the middle of an emergency on the road thinking things through. Let's see, which way do I turn the wheel on this? Which way do I turn the wheel on that? Or if you're in a martial arts competition, your body has to know what it is to do. We used to call that motor memory. We really know that's a different kind of memory system. But we have to train ourselves to do things the right way below our level of cognitive consciousness.
So, and one other thing I'm hearing here is, and I've read in the book, is awareness. That's a key component.
Yes.
If you're not aware you're doing something wrong, or you're not aware there's a problem,
it's hard
to do anything about it.
How can you possibly think there's something wrong if you're not aware that there might be something wrong? Right. Awareness is a key component. And nowadays, the fancy term they use, I think, is mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
So simply being aware of your environment, and your environment is where you are, the four walls around you, where you're standing, and it's also your internal environment. You have a queasy feeling in your stomach or your shoulders sort of rising up to your ears because you're tense. Pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Pay attention.
Put them down.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's true because we have this tendency to be going, what's next, preparing for what's coming up next, and not really thinking about what's happening in this moment. And that gets back to the same thing with just listening to what's happening in our own bodies. Like you're saying, you notice your shoulders, okay, why am I stressed? What's going on here? You know, and really stop to think about that. You might prevent yourself from having some kind of physical ailments down the line.
That's really true. That's really true. If you always go around with your muscles very tense, and for example, you slip and fall, it's going to be potentially more damaging to a body part that fell than if you were very very loose, you know. And also, if you have more muscle tone, you're going to be in better shape than someone who's let themselves go. So, paying attention to what your body is telling you and being able to interpret it correctly is very important to keeping healthy and having a long, happy life.
We're talking with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese. His new book is 10 Lessons in Power Psychology. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626, and press the number 5. You can email us, thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a quick break.